configuration thing. All I get is a little ding.
Yeah, by default it reads it to you, but that, and also, at least if you're talking, that comes out on the podcast. So most people go in and turn that off. And I'm recording this now as well, since Honky seems to be having some amount of technical difficulties. Might have to go on and get off. So I'm sorry I didn't think of that earlier.
Magic. I'm going to check.
Yeah, I'm slowly creeping up on getting onto Facebook, but I don't really work well with a lot of these social networking systems yet.
I do not like how in G Plus, when you click in the search bar to try to find a community or a particular individual that their posts, and it drags you through their featured collections, which they seem to somehow some have some kind of vested interest in having you join. And while Phoebe's typing in the topics, I've been adding the associated links that were in these Google Plus posts.
All right, how about now?
Yay!
Very
Yeah,
clear.
I can hear you too.
Man, it's a shame Father Finch isn't here. He and Kevin had a nice long talk about that NetGate SG-1000.
Yeah, and I have a comment on that, but I'll wait till we get to the show.
Yeah, so it's weird. The system I'm recording on, it seems to, I'm not sure if it's the mic or what, but the whole system seems to be bad. I'm not sure if I just need to reinstall the OS or what.
So does that mean your recording's borked so far?
No, oddly enough, the recordings seem to be okay. Don't know why, but the recordings seem to be okay through all this. Like, you remember back when you guys couldn't hear me at all, and I just apparently sounded like sidelining, and what I got when I obviously sounded fine because I was the one recording, and everybody else sounded fine over my connection. I mean, that episode came out great, and I had a couple of weeks ago where like everything was just failing on me, and I couldn't do anything with the laptop. I came to Mumble, and that recording came out fine too. So the recording seems to come out fine. It's just me interacting with the computer during that time seems to be where the problem is.
Are you saying the problem is between the chair and the keyboard? Just joking.
Oh, it probably is, but I'm going to blame it on the fact that I'm using a version of Bodhi right before they've switched from the Enlightenment to the Moksha desktop from the version like right before. Probably that has probably nothing to do with it.
Don't know, it's hard to tell. There's so many things.
All right, during the I just installed no matter we were talking about Sparky Linux, I just installed it on my old desktop machine that I used to use as my recording and editing machine. And I had that set up and going and recording during the 26-hour New Year's Eve, HPR New Year's Eve show. And somehow like I was trying to be really good at like every around 4 hours coming down, stopping the recording and starting it up again, because anything after like probably around 4 hours, the audio just starts to get all wonky, and it's I don't know what happens after 4 hours of recording in Mumble. It just doesn't work right. And somehow after about 4 hours, I checked on it. I checked on it late. It was up to like 6 hours of recording. I wasn't able to like touch anything in Mumble. Mumble just kind of froze up on me. And I was able to go on, and those who were there during that time, because I was there like right around midnight Eastern Standard Time, I was able to come on, and I was on the recording machine, and I was able to talk on Mumble and stuff, but I wasn't able to stop the recording, do anything with the recording, or I don't think do much else with the machine at the time. And so I just kind of left it going, and after that, the machine just wouldn't reboot. It was, I think I shut it down at some point, and it's I basically got to reinstall something because it won't boot at all.
Can you get the recording off of it?
No, but I had a secondary recording where I was recording off the stream, Ken had given me an example of recording off this of how to use MPlayer to record off the stream, and I did it that way, and that recording came out great. I've already gotten the show edited. Now I'm just I'm listening to the whole. So it recorded. I recorded for probably 33 hours. After truncating silence, we got 22 hours worth of audio, and I now have to basically listen to it because there's next to nothing for show notes. You go back to that Etherpad. Thank goodness Ken put the mumble chat in the Etherpad, but there was next to nothing for show notes. So I got to listen through and put show notes for each episode. I have 6 episodes. The first 4 are 4 hours long, and then the last 2 are 3 hours long.
Well, you're a good man for doing that, because I realized at the end that I hadn't put hardly anything in the show notes either. I mean, yeah, there's some there for the first couple hours, and then nothing after that.
That's fine. I found there's I use AntennaPod on my phone, and so I decided to listen to it through AntennaPod. And there's a plugin for AntennaPod to speed up the audio. And I've heard a lot of people talk about speeding up audio, and I never really tried it before because, I don't know, I just kind of appreciated the fact of like hearing people talk at the normal rate. But I figured at this point, I basically got to power through 22 hours worth of audio. So I'm like, I'm going to speed this thing up. I've been listening to it at 1.75, and it's not that big of a difference to me.
I was listening to all my podcasts about 1.75 for almost a year. And then I realized that, maybe it's just it was me being myself, but it seemed like my attention span had just decreased, and I couldn't like concentrate on things as well as I used to. So I backed it off, and things seemed to be coming back to normal. But I'm not sure if anybody else has noticed that out there.
Well, there's a lot of times I'm listening to a podcast and then sitting at the computer or watching a video or stuff, and sitting at the computer and you know, trying to work something out, and it's just like, no, I can't do both at the same time. So, you know, I have to stop the podcast and wait till I work through the problem, then turn it back on.
I'm not sure if I'll use it for like my everyday podcast consumption, but I definitely appreciate it for what I'm doing. And I've debated pushing it up to the 2, but I think around the 2, I'm going to start losing things. And I'm wondering whether when I start getting to points where, like right now at the beginning, it was a lot of like 50 and Reg A, and then it was like me and Reg A, and then it was Reg A and Nightwise for a while. And that's basically where I'm at. But it's, you know, you're talking about it's just one, it's between 2 to 3 people talking at a time. But once you get to later on, it becomes like around midnight Eastern Standard, there was probably a good, I was worried about the cap of the 20 cap, because there was probably a good like 15, 16 people in the room at a time. And a lot of us were, you know, we weren't fighting to try to speak, but there was a lot of us who, you know, wanted to speak, so it's consistent. So I'm wondering whether if I speed it up at the 1.75, well, I'm going to be lose some of it or what.
Well, I know we were hitting the cap because my internet dropped out, and you know, so I had to go out and come back in and then hit that. Nope, you're 21. You can't, you know. So usually we get that raised, you know, and thanks to John Neustetter for the hosting every year, but. I don't know if somebody mentioned it to him. I mean, like last year he forgot and turned it up in the middle of the show. And he said, yeah, somebody, I did know about it and I just forgot to do it. So I don't know if that was, you know, this year, if nobody communicated to him, we're going to do the show again and just assumed, or what that was. But I don't think we probably did a disservice to too many people, but if there's anybody out there who wanted to get in and couldn't get in at one of the high activity times, I apologize.
See, I know I sent an email out to him asking him, basically just asking his permission to be able to use his server for this. And I really didn't ask about upping the number of participants at all. So that might be on me. Next time I'll ask him early on. But I mean, he knew what was going on, but you know, I didn't bother to ask about upping it. So next time I'll remember to ask early.
Well, now we've got Honky back. You know, we're almost an hour late officially starting the show. So should we get into it?
Sure. The question, as always, is who wants to do the hosting?
I would volunteer, but if you look at the show notes, people are going to get tired of hearing my voice anyway.
I can stumble through the intro. Guess that means I should read it, huh?
Well, if you're waiting for permission, please go ahead.
Welcome to the Linux Lugcast. We're an open podcast/lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every Friday and first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining exactly how to configure Mumble. Then you can join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us on IRC on Freenode on the Linux Lugcast channel. And if you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mailing list. Just visit our website for the direct links. All right, so welcome to episode 70, and Happy New Year. I'm Fweeb, and with us tonight we have 5150.
Howdy, folks.
Honky Magoo.
Evening and Happy New Year.
Netminer.
Yes, Happy New Year, and happy little Christmas.
And Tony Bemis.
Hello, everybody.
Cool. Now, shuffling on forward, we got a lot of feedback on our Google Plus community page since the last show. I guess the first one up to bat was Kevin Wisher posted a link to Nagios on a Pi 3. Anybody want to talk about that one?
Well, actually, the link from the Google Plus is actually a review of the Nemo version of Nagios on the Pi 3 that was posted on Cat 5. So, of course, you know, the direct link will be in there. And if you scroll down, I'll talk about this some because this is this is actually my first item on my show notes. I guess the second image. Or not Nemo, NEMS. And if you guys remember, I bought Pi 2 last year specifically to put Nagios on because somebody found an image out there that was Raspbian with Nagios already installed. Of course, you can just, you know, I've tried some various things like manually installing Raspbian, but it was on the Diet Pi, and I had just way too many things going on for anything to work. So this was posted again the other day. I thank Claudio in Facebook. I don't remember for sure, but I followed that link, and I can attest that, you know, it just works. You just install it, follow the instructions. You know, you want to change the user and root passwords. I haven't replaced the default user, which is Pi, with, you know, with another user because I didn't want to take the chance on breaking the thing yet. Sometimes you create a user and it does not necessarily bring in all the groups that, you know, the custom user that's been put on there is set up. But, you know, changing the password is fine for security. So it's up and running on my network, and you log into its, you know, you go to a browser and you go to the IP of the device, and, you know, it's got a beautiful interface on top of it, which I think is specific to NEMS. Now, the one thing I haven't done, it's just sitting there, but it can't really do anything because for it to communicate with all devices on your network, you have to install monitoring software on each and every host to communicate with the Nagios server. And of course, the drawback of that is, I don't know if it's more than a negligible, but, you know, every time you install a resident program that's running all the time, obviously that's going to have at least some effect on your performance. And the link's pretty short, even though it's in the show notes. I'll read it out. It's baldnerd.com/NEMS. And just based on the guy's handle, I think we ought to invite him to be on the show sometime. But this, you know, this is what I've been looking for nearly a year. Just a out of the box solution. Put Nagios on your Raspberry Pi. Boom, done. Now, one thing on the website is he doesn't think a 2 is fast enough. He says I'm only supporting 3. You know, it may run on earlier versions, but don't ask me any questions because I'm not going to support anything before the Raspberry Pi 3. So, and you know, mine's not doing anything but sitting there being a server right now. So I may find out that in actual practice, I need a little more horsepower.
I wonder if PFSense has a Nagios interface.
I think so. That's an interesting question, and you know, I'll look for it between before the next episode, because of course that's on there too. Well, no, you guys already knew it. I had my PFSense server up and running, so I'll see.
And moving forward with the feedback, Kevin Wisher also posted a link to a very cool little micro firewall, a little NetGate SG1000. And I really wish that Father Finch were here, because he and Kevin Wisher had a nice long discussion on there, about 15 comments worth of back and forth related to this cute little device here. Actually, Honky, you were in that a little bit too, weren't you?
Well, looking at that, I just wonder whether, you know, it seems to me that what that is it almost looks like the equivalent of a, you know, like a Banana Pi R1 or like a Raspberry Pi, but just stripped down. It seems like a very simple thing, or the thing that's required for this seems very simple. And that's, I kind of questioned the amount that they want for it. They want $150 for this, which is basically like a Raspberry Pi, but with 2 dedicated NICs.
Well, this is based on the Texas Instruments version of the ARM chipset. And point one, this means that there is an ARM build of PFSense, but it's not out there available for download. The only way you get it is with this machine. Also, they say, you know, along with it, you get a year of the pro paid version of PFSense, which is like, I think $100 a year is what they say on there. Probably worth it, but you know, after 365 days, does this drop back to the free version of PFSense, or is it only run on the pro version? So are you having to pay, if you buy this, do you have to keep paying $100 a year to keep it working?
That's a good question too. And I almost feel like if they did a better job, like I talked to like several months ago about trying to put IP Fire on the Banana Pi, and I know it's not going to be nearly as powerful because those are dedicated gigabit NICs as opposed to, you know, mine, which was a gigabit NIC with a USB NIC. But it almost seems like for what I'm using it for, the Banana Pi R1, if it could stay up consistently, which I had problems with, and you know, they seem to be struggling with keeping going, and anytime I saw it in the in their discussions there on their site, that you know, they're not doing much to actually support running it on the Banana Pi. But if I can get that working persistently, then that would serve my purposes. And you know, it's just the price of a Banana Pi as opposed to $150 for this thing. And $150 isn't a huge amount, but it's not, you know, it's not cheap.
Not cheap in the general sense, but it is worth pointing out. I think both Kevin and Father Finch pointed out on G Plus, and actually he's saying so on IRC as well, that because it has 2 gigabit connectors at that price, there's to get that level of throughput at that price is pretty rare. So there's something to be said for that.
Well, I certainly didn't pay any more for the dual core, I think Celeron box, you know, that I'm running pfSense on that had the two built-in NICs. But of course, it's, you know, it's going to consume more energy by quite a bit than this machine. I mean, but you know, price-wise, I've spent about the same money as what one of these things is. But over the course of the year, you know, what, maybe $20 more energy consumption? Who knows?
Well, one thing you might want to look at, this also has a crypto subsystem.
That's also true.
So can you explain what a crypto subsystem is?
Dedicated cryptographic hardware accelerator. A crypto CPU, like a GPU, but for VPN type stuff. Also, I wonder if those are two real gigabit interfaces, because when they say two interfaces switch, that seems a little weird. The Banapi router has one interface and a switch.
Right, I wanted to bring that up. You know, I'd also tried, still got the Banapi router, and I believe my roadblock was I had DDWRT on it, but I could never find the default password to get into it. So, but you know, having looked at, I think managing DDWRT, you're going to have to do a little more homework in the things than you have to do for pfSense, which, you know, it's just point and click pretty much.
I'm running DDWRT right now, and it's through the web interface at least. It's no more difficult than any commercial router, at least, with a lot more features.
Yeah, I agree. My router is running DDWRT also.
I must admit that I haven't enabled a lot of my pfSense. I've been pretty basic, you know, one LAN, one WAN. But again, a lot of the horsepower was reserved for future use.
Cool. Well, let's slide forward to the next little bit of feedback, because we got quite a bit. Rick Sloan posts about Pi-hole. They got updated to version 2. And basically turns your Raspberry, as he says, it turns your Raspberry Pi or any Debian or Ubuntu distribution into an advertising black hole.
Yeah, essentially what that does, and a lot of these devices do, you set it up so the Pi-hole box is your DNS server. So it's connecting to the internet outside, you know, to your ISP's DNS. But you go in your router and you set DNS for all the hosts as the IP of the Pi hole. And of course it's going through one interface up and one interface back, but it's essentially got a blacklist of of websites, advertising websites that you just don't get anything. You get a banner that says this has been blocked or whatever, or link says this has been blocked, but you don't actually see the advertising. And again, a few months ago I tried this, and it was on that Diet Pi box, and I had just too many things on it that I think it were working against each other, so it didn't work. But now that, you know, that's one thing I have been thinking about. You hate to get getting ahead of myself. I'm thinking of putting Pi hole, because it is essentially Raspbian, you know, and I can SSH into it and interface with it just like any other Raspbian host or Debian host. So I think I would be okay, you know, just going in and installing Pi hole on it alongside the Nagio software. But you know, when you've got a purpose built image to do one thing, yeah, in another way you hate to go kicking at it. Though if I screw it up, I could just, you know, go back to the fresh image.
Cool. And next up, we have Ron. I'm going to butcher the last name. It's only four letters. Hoke. I'm horrible at this. In any case, has a link to the Arch Linux wiki for an explicit way to disable the touchpad. This is actually feedback to feedback, because if you remember last episode, Richard Klein was specifically asking for a way to disable the touchpad as part of Joe's plan to rewrite touchpad drivers as a feature request. So Ron has posted a link to the ArchWiki page that describes how to shut it down with the existing Synaptix driver.
That's awesome. I really want to look into this, because personally that drives me nuts at times. I can't tell you how many times I'll be typing something out and then have my thumb slide down to the touchpad on some of my computers and then just completely screw up, because it'll jump the cursor down to the middle of the page or somewhere else in the page, and I'll just not notice and keep typing, and then it's just all freaking messed up. So that's pretty cool. I really want to look into it.
Yeah, same here. I miss having there. I've had a number of laptops that had a hardware button that just turned off the touchpad. It just bound right to the hardware, and I miss having that.
Yeah, but I'm kind of I'm slowly going against the idea of hardware buttons. I got one laptop here that's got a hardware button for the Wi-Fi, and it's getting to an age where that hardware button is so sensitive that if it gets touched ever so gently over to the left-hand side, it'll screw up my Wi-Fi on that laptop.
That just means you need a new laptop.
That's true, but I don't have money for a new laptop.
Fair enough. All right, and the last little feedback was actually Richard Klein posting a link to a USB to 2.1 millimeter barrel jack for power. There's a chance this was posted to the wrong community.
Yeah, or maybe meant to post it to both, or, you know, I've been bringing a inordinate amount of mini PC topics lately, so perhaps it's becoming hard for people to distinguish us between us and the mini PC show, and really that's mainly because I can afford to buy one of these little cheap machines and play with it. I can't afford to buy new desktops and play with them. So though I would caution on that, most of the mini PCs that use the barrel connector do so because USB doesn't provide enough amps to run that machine, especially things like the Odroid. So what this is it's a cable with the 2.1 millimeter barrel jack on one end and a regular standard USB plug on the other end, and you'd plug that into your regular USB charger. And on that, a lot of the chargers for your cell phones or whatever, I wouldn't want to use those on a Raspberry Pi in the first place. I think I'd rather have one, where it's hardwired all the way through and is able to provide, I think 3 amps at the, at least be able to provide 3 amps. So I know the Odroid likes 3 amps, so you can probably get by with the 2.5 on the Raspberry Pi, but I don't, I don't think your regular phone your generic charger that you buy at Walmart that plugs in the wall and has a USB jack in it, I wouldn't count on it being providing even that much power. So if your mini PC has a barrel connector, it's probably got it for a reason.
Rocking, and that's the feedback we got. Now we're just gonna get to the show, and at this point, 5150, go ahead and take it, man.
Yeah, sorry about this. I just had a bunch of things this month I thought were interesting. This one just came up. First one just came up earlier this week, and friend was trying to. He has an old Sony camcorder, and I say old, probably not more than about 5-6 years. Well, it could be 10. Sony only provided drivers for XP and then abandoned it. And, you know, he used to have a bunch of computers on the network, but went with a new provider, and he's just, you know, he has one new laptop, and he's connected to the internet through it, and then he doesn't have the rest of the network wired into the uplink. So that was a Windows 7 computer, and I guess he tried to get the drivers working, but he wanted me to help him. But we got there, and something's download screwed up where he could, you know, it let him go into Yahoo and Google, but not doesn't seem like anything else works. That was our first stumbling point. And his router wouldn't be, you know, couldn't be configured as a bridge. So it's not like I could wirelessly connect the rest of his network into the new uplink. So I brought my laptop, you know, running SUSE, and I thought there might be a chance that the driver support would be enough better in Linux that I could just plug in the camcorder to the SUSE laptop and have it automatically be recognized. Well, that didn't work, but we're working for a way to do an uplink. And he said, well, let's get your computer on the web. And went to configure the wireless. I was hoping he wouldn't ask me to do that, really, because I've had some hinky stuff with the wireless that, you know, just here in the house. I got a couple laptops like that. I don't know why, but you know, one day you'll get them to link up wirelessly, and the other day you won't. And I prefer wired Ethernet for everything anyway, if I can get it. So has been much of a problem. But I went in; it looked like the card wasn't there. So, you know, I did ifconfig, and I had eth0 and the loopback. Didn't have WLAN at all. then I did an LSPCI. And it showed both the wired and wireless Ethernet cards. So it was acting like we were just talking a minute ago, either a keyboard or a switched, you know, on-off on the Ethernet or on the wireless. And I do have, you know, the function key combined with the F key, you know, icon on there, turn on and off. I wasn't sure if that would be the same under Linux as it was under Windows, but I tried toggling it both ways and it didn't work. But it wasn't until I got home and got back, you know, on the internet.
All right, did my internet drop or something happened to 50?
I'm sorry, I was using the mouse and I took my finger off the button. Sorry about that. Like I said, wasn't until I got home till I figured out what was able to go on the internet and diagnose the problem. And there's a link for that in the show notes, which I'm not going to try to read out. But essentially, the first step is you do sudo ifconfig wlan0 up. And for this particular problem, the telltale is the message you get back is SIOCSIF flags. Operation not possible due to RF kill. Okay, so the next step you would do is sudo RF kill list all. Well, I didn't have RF kill installed yet, and sudo, I guess that's not something default. So I went and installed the RF. I updated everything. Then I installed the RF kill package, and just like it shows here in this example. When I did RF kill list all, I got the example back, PHY 0, wireless LAN, soft blocked yes, hard blocked no. And then it also tests Bluetooth, if you have it. Okay, so what do you do? The next part is what do you do if you, to correct this? And the answer is a ways down here. Just a minute. Okay. Like I said, first I had to install RFKill. Then you issue sudo rfkill unblock Wi-Fi and also sudo rfkill unblock all. And then you do sudo rfkill list to confirm that it's been unblocked. And where it said yes before, it'll say no. Then to get your Wi-Fi working, you have to reboot. And there's more diagnostics. You do sudo rfkill list again to confirm that it, you know, it's still working, and sudo lshw space dash class space network, and that'll tell you if the kernel has recognized your wireless card. So that, you know, once I knew what I was doing there, that was easy enough to fix. But that could be one of those things, if you just didn't have experience with it, could drive you crazy trying to find it. Any comments or questions on that? Okay, seeing none. Point two, we've already talked about in the feedback that I can attest, NEMS, you know, just works like butter. Just download it, install it, follow the prompts. Of course, like I said, I don't have it actually doing anything yet because I haven't gone around and put the diagnostic clients on my machine. So once I've done that, I'll come back with another report. And I think we probably discussed that already enough. Third point, over Christmas, Black Friday, just what prompted this, I've got a Netscape security, wireless security cam. And essentially, it's just the one part is, looks like a Wi-Fi patch panel. That's essentially what it is. And then the other is a battery-powered remote camera, which I have one gate here onto the property that's open. So I could, you know, I put it there so I could see, have a video of anybody driving through the gate. And I won't go into, you know, this was just sort of a quick and dirty thing because I really want to build a better solution, but I figured for the discounted price, it'd be something to try. But the way this works is with an app on your phone or on an Android device. On the local network, you cannot communicate or look or anything, you know, access that device at all. You only access it through an app, and all the video is recorded into the cloud. You know, which, you know, in a way could be a good thing because, you know, if somebody came in and wrecked the house or whatever, or something, well, they're not, you know, that they can't erase that evidence because it's already on the cloud and available to them. But I'm thinking, really, there is no reason to have this thing where it can talk to stuff on my, you know, on the same network as the rest of my devices. Netscape apparently is keeping the firmware up to date, because the first time I turned it on, both the patch panel base station and the camera separately updated their firmware. So, you know, so as far as that goes, I kind of trust Netscape not to really have a vested interest in spying on me. And if it ever got out that they did, that would be very damaging to their business model. But still, since there's absolutely no reason for this thing to be on my network other than to have internet access, that's the way I wanted to do it. So I also, for that purpose, I got a USB Ethernet interface card and plugged it into the pfSense box and configured that as a separate network. I also plan, when I get this working, to place my two, quote, smart TVs on it so they can get updates, but they can't see any of the other traffic on my network and any other IoT devices that I may buy that have no purpose or, you know, have no utility being able to talk to the rest of my network. Okay, so so I set up that second network by default. When you set up pfSense, the WAN port, it, you know, is labeled WAN. The other, you know, the first LAN port is labeled LAN. Of course, you can change the names. Second LAN port is OPT1 for optional. And by default, it gets, you know, if you look at the configuration for LAN and the configuration for the OPT1, other than they're on different address ranges, there doesn't seem to be any difference. But when I plug a device in OPT1, it can't see the internet. So I plug the camera in, it stops working. I go to the app on my phone that says, nope, you know, your camera's not connected. Okay, so and I really haven't tried out, you know, I really ought to plug in a laptop so I can do more diagnostics. You know, obviously I can't do anything interactive from that camera. But if you go on the forums and you do a search on this problem, it seems like this is the number one most common search out there for pfSense. And the pfSense people are more like, well, we don't understand what the problem is. It should just work. But first problem, I can ping, you know, that camera from a device on the other local network. There are two separate LANs. And I can ping across them, which is what I don't want to do. I do not want communication between those two networks. And secondly, nothing on that op network seems to be able to find the internet. So I'm kind of putting that out there. Maybe Tony knows what's going on, you know, to get a little help, because I did do a lot of Google search trying to find this, and unfortunately a lot of the answers are, you know, somebody gets into this, but they're saying, oh, I changed this, you know, whereas my system is a little more pristine, and I hate to go down a rabbit hole, that is, and thanks, Phoebe, for correcting my spelling, I hate to go down a rabbit hole of changing a bunch of stuff. You know, because you go to one site and this guy had done a bunch of stuff, and another site they've done other stuff. You know, I don't want to start changing so many things that I can't get back to where I need to be. So I'm just hoping maybe somebody out there has done something like this and knows just exactly what I need to do.
Yeah, actually, I
know what it is.
Same thing. What do you think it is, Miner?
Default gateway. Where is this gateway? And if the LANs can talk to each other, you may be gatewaying onto each other instead of gatewaying onto the internet.
Yeah, actually, the default gateway and everything for the configuration of the device, of either your laptop or the camera, all that is configured correctly, because the routing part is working. The pfSense box is routing between the two networks, and what you need is a firewall rules turned on to be able to allow internet access out. So by default, the pfSense blocks all internet access, or blocks all access completely, until you say turn it on to go out to the internet. So what you want to do is go into the firewall and then rules section and look at your LAN and look at those rules and then copy those or recreate them again on the OPT1 interface, and then that should allow it out. But then you also need to create more firewall rules that will block the communication between the two networks.
Okay, and I had seen some posts on that and really had done that. You know, I'd got that far and it didn't seem to do any good. And I'd seen other people say, yeah, we did this and it's still not working. So I know exactly what you mean, Tony, 'cause I've been there.
Okay. Then if you need some help, maybe I can review it in or and take a look at those rules for you, and we can see where the block is happening.
Okay, yeah, if you'd have time for that sometime, I'd appreciate the help.
Yeah, no problem.
That's what
you might want to. You might want to screenshot your rule set, and you know, then send it off as a so that somebody could say, "Oh, the rules are set this way."
Okay, yeah, I'll try that. I think right now I've gone back to no rules on Opti 1 because you know trying to recreate the ones that were on land didn't seem to work. But that's one of the things. I didn't want to go too far down the rabbit hole and then it gets so screwed up I couldn't get back.
By the way, I've looking at the configuration, one reason I haven't messed with mine is that I've been studying a lot of how to set it up on the rule sets and stuff. They have I believe they have a feature that allows you to clone rules. So you don't have to do copy and paste. It will actually clone the rule, and then you just move it around to where you need.
You know, I was looking for something like that, and I'm in my PSense right now, and I don't see the cloned rule option, but it would be really nice to have that.
Well, you may have to look at the right tutorials, but I've seen them talk about that, especially in configuring things like VPN.
Okay, well, still related to point four, still related to the PFSense box. The computer it's based on does have a 5 gigahertz and a 2.4 gigahertz wireless NIC in there, but PFSense doesn't seem to recognize it. And I don't know if it's because it's BSD, that there's drivers for these NICs in by default in Linux, but I'd have to go find them and install it for BSD, or if maybe PFSense doesn't want to deal with wireless NICs. I'm not sure what, but I had two factory routers. And the one that I was using as my router, I didn't want to mess with configuration, so I could keep it in reserve in case I screwed up the PFSense box and I could put it back on the old router. But, you know, the other router I had, which had the exact same configuration, I had set up. So, if I had one router go bad, I could immediately switch to the other. And there's just a one-click thing in there to create as an access point, so I didn't have to put the wireless key or anything like that back in. It just, essentially be the same thing as turning off DHCP. So I've been using that with the PFSense box as my wireless access point. And it's weird, I have used it, just as the router before and never had any problem, but I've been having the problem. I'm watching something on the Chromecast and it'll just stop. And I go back into the Android device, and that the Chromecast for that TV, it just suddenly isn't there anymore. And I could always fix it by rebooting the access point. So I figure it's in the access point rather than anyplace else. So I thought, okay, what's the easiest thing I could do to replace the access point? My Orange Pi Zeros do have a built-in WIP antenna. It's nowhere near as big as like a one on a USB dongle that has an antenna, so I doubted really if that would give me the coverage I needed, but I figured there ought to be a real simple way to turn a Linux box into an access point. I installed Armbian for the Orange Pi Zero, and Joe's right. I really like that distribution. The Orange Pi Zero is a headless box, so you have to SSH into it. So I think one of the things you don't want to get into it right away because it's got a resize. First thing it does, like Raspbian, is extend the partition to use up the whole SD card. But then you can SSH into it, and the first thing it does you know, before it lets you do anything else, it says you need to change the root password, because the default root password is 1234. Then it says, okay, now you need to create a regular user account. So you do that. And then, you know, everything just works great. But again, I did a bunch of Google research, couldn't find anything that would turn it into an access point like I would want. There is a bridge command in Linux, and that creates a virtual network device that is the bridge between the, well, could be any two NICs, but of course in this situation between the between ETH zero and WLAN zero. But with, this was actually designed to bridge networks, not create an access point. So every single network interface that you connect to it wirelessly, you have to beforehand put in the MAC address. You know, is list, in the configuration, there's a list of MAC addresses they're allowed to connect. So that, you know, it's probably good for security, but not very good for convenience. Also, I didn't try it, but there, you know, that it's also said out there that a system configured like that is not going to let Android devices connect. It'll let Linux boxes, I assume Windows or whatever, connect, but it's not going to recognize an Android device. So I thought there's got to be an easy way to do this. Thought I found it. Link in the show notes. It's on web update. There's a PPA that includes a script, or did, to automatically do what I was wanting. Unfortunately, I'd installed the Armbian version, or no, I'm sorry, I installed the Debian version of Armbian because I figured it would be lighter. So, you know, then I saw PPA, I said, okay, I'll go download the Unix version. And since it's a headless box, I'm assuming, I haven't really checked to see, but I'm assuming there's not a GUI on either of these images. So went back all the way back through it with Ubuntu, got the box set up, updated, then installed the PPA. And then tried to run this script and says it said not, you know, couldn't find it. So at some point, the article's a couple years old, so this script must have been deprecated or renamed or whatever. But then I started going, that's okay, because the manual, you know, all the steps that would be in the script are also there on the web page. So I just started going through manually. Unfortunately, you know, neither the built-in wireless interface or, you know, the USB interface adapter I bought for another project were recognized at that point. And that was something that they mentioned on the page. It's, well, you know, we got, you know, we'll probably get most of the wireless network cards, but certainly not all of them, and we're not doing any more work on this project. So you're on your own at that point. So I'm still looking for, you know, I don't want to be too easy, because this is something I should know how to do once I learn how to do it. I mean, it shouldn't be a black box that I don't understand. But it should be a lot easier, I'm thinking, than it seems to be. So I'll pause here for comment.
Well, as far as pfSense really, really handles basic G chipsets from what I, USB chipsets from what I understand. For N and up, they really prefer you to use some kind of access point.
Okay. Well, that kind of solves me thinking, even trying to mess with those internal NICs then.
Yeah, really a bad idea. Also, what you do is you build your interface, your opt whatever interface, and you put that one, you enabled the portal facility on it for security, is that's how you work. I don't know how you do an open one, but that's all part of the portal system.
Well, the portal is another feature you just turn on. So if you don't want to have people hit the accept button or to be able to see a page every time they connect first, then it just allows them to go through.
Okay, I didn't realize that was the default.
It would end up being like your other IoT interface or whatever, where you just have a wireless, guest wireless, and tell it to only has internet access.
Okay. And this, so I've been having trouble with this. I got a flyer from Newegg and, in email and looked and saw, oh, they're having a sale on Ethernet switches. And, for all this stuff that I want to put on the guest network, I would have to have some sort of switch. I can't imagine I would ever have 24 devices on that guest network, but on the other hand, I hate to find out years later that I bought like an 8-port or a 16-port switch and I needed more links. So saw one fairly good discount, similar to the switches that I already have. But then going through checkout, I found, there's an option to get this with a sonic wall access point. And see, this is where I screwed up. If I'd looked it up, and I should have known better, I was confusing the sonic wall with the Ubiquiti access point. And I put in Ubiquiti's for customers, and I'll talk about them in a minute. They just work great. And I'm sure SonicWall is a very good product too, but the difference between them is they're both really enterprise-level access points. But the difference is the SonicWall, which is a Dell product, requires a dedicated central management box, which is like another $200. So it's obviously not an option for a small business or a home, whereas Ubiquiti does all the same thing in software, and they're both really set up for not having just one access point, but you have a plant or an installation or something where you have 30 access points around the building, and where it could be a problem. Your connected device is constantly switching back and forth between them. So that's why you have the management software. And you can set it up in both of them. If you've got a graphic for a floor plan of, your building, then you could drag, access point one, drag its icon into the room where it is, and so on for the rest of them. And that helps the management software or hardware, map out what's the best way to provide internet coverage or wireless coverage for everybody. But, just for a home, just a single Ubiquiti. If you want something you can get and it's just flat out works, because the reason I got them for the school years ago, I'd had just regular consumer access points, D-Links and whatever in the rooms, and they would have like a laptop lab where they had 16 laptops, and I don't know why, but usually you could get about 10 of them to connect, and then that was about it. So, some days you get them all to connect, but obviously you're just your regular D-Link access point or router turned into an access point in my case was not up to the task. And the superintendent at the time, he thought, well, we can put an access point in each hall, down each hallway, and that's all we need. And I said, yeah, in some schools that would work, but you're in a cinder block building. All the walls, internal walls, are cinder block, and you know, you have steel beams holding up the roof. You're essentially in a giant Faraday cage. And once I finally convinced them to put Ubiquiti in each and every room where they needed wireless, never had a problem with that again. So I can't say enough good things about that particular product. Unfortunately, I was stupid and didn't do the 5 minutes worth of research that would tell me what I was getting, what wasn't what I was thinking of, and didn't realize it till I opened the box last night and started looking at the instructions. And since it was a package deal, I'll probably have to return it and the switch and all, and start all over again and take the hit on restocking and shipping and all that. So if you want to see some more about the Ubiquiti, I've got links. Tom Lawrence has talked about it a couple times on his YouTube channel, so there's links in the show notes there.
Is the Ubiquiti product also called Unify?
Yeah, Ubiquiti is the company, and then Unify is one of the models.
Because with the SG 1000, they talk about the Unify Lite and Unify Pro as being the access points that they support.
Right, and also Tom did one, a later one. Well, I mean, fairly recent. I guess they have a new product that's not meant for in-room. It's meant to go between buildings and has like a 10-kilometer range. So I looked at that and thought that might be a solution, except I'd be shooting through trees, I think, to, you know, I would like to have internet access at my old place. Occasionally, you know, you're working out there in the shop and you try to find a parts manual online, something like that. And I used to have that when I lived there, but now that I don't, you know, I'd like to have that again. So I'm also thinking of that product for that.
Actually, Linux Tech Tips, if it's the one that I'm thinking of, it has a 25-kilometer range.
And that last part just wasn't strictly Linux, because these are all, you know, but they're, the Ubiquiti is a good tool to use with Linux. So I just, I wanted to go ahead and mention that and expose my complete stupidity for all to see. Okay. I've pretty much moved as my daily driver over to the dual boot tower, running Solus for open source. And, you know, we've mentioned before on the show, Ikey and crew have pretty good, you know, they're pretty much believing in one tool for one job. So they don't, unlike a lot of other Linuxes, you don't have support for every possible package under the sun in the repositories. And I'd been used to using on SUSE console for my terminal emulator, and the default one in Solus, the difference really is, and the only difference is tabbed windows. You know, the default one in Solus, you know, won't let you do a tab, and I like to open up another tab and, you know, SSH into a machine from there. You know, I'd rather not have another whole window, but, you know, of course, that probably really doesn't make any difference between that and the tab, other than just space on your screen. But I really wanted a tabbed terminal emulator, and did find in the software manager Rocks term, which is multi-tab. So don't think I like it quite as well as I like console, but it's still, you know, it works. It does what I'm wanting. Also, the default file manager, which is unlabeled, I don't know what it is, in Solus also does not support tabs. And for about the same reason, I like to have one tab open as my local drive, and then the other tab that goes to my mapped network drive. Sunflower that you can install in Solus, it's a file manager that supports tabs. I still prefer Funar, but for right now I can get by with Sunflower. Just pausing for the next topic.
Before you do that, did I hear right that Ike is going to be on a show on a podcast called was it Late Night Linux?
Oh yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's Joe Resington's show. You may remember. The show just stopped. So, not like it was that long ago. Joe was a participant in Linux Luddites, and the other part of that crew, they've had a change in their employment. So, not going to be able to participate in the show anymore. So, unfortunately, Linux Luddites has now come to an end, but Joe's starting another show called Late Night Linux, and he did mention on the 24-hour show that he was going to have Ike as a guest. Thanks, Honky, for
reminding. Have you checked that out? Have you checked that out yet at all?
No, I haven't. In fact, let me go right now and do a Google search on that so I can find it. When if there's already a link up, I'll put it in the show notes. And while I'm doing that, I can probably talk at the same time. This is another Solus issue that I came across. I had been, when I was SSHing into remote systems from this one, of course, I've been typing the password for the remote account in every time. And I got, the other night, I got thinking, okay, this is when I am going to go in and exchange secure keys so I don't have to type the passwords in anymore. And tried SSH-copy-ID, which is what you use. You copies your secure key into a remote system. It's, sort of like very much like an SSH command. You do that, at space username at IP of the remote system. I tried SSH copy ID, and this is not found. So I did an EO package search and couldn't find a package that had it in there, and did a search on SSH copy dash ID or SSH dash copy dash ID and Solus, and found a page that says, no, we don't think that's secure, so we didn't include it. So that's not in the repos. So the link I have on the page, if you're using a version of Linux that doesn't support SSH dash copy dash ID, it's how to do it manually. Here, let me open that. Trying to do too many things and talk at once.
While you do that, I'm looking in the link that you have on there. I'm not seeing anything specific about Solus saying that they don't find that secure.
No, that was a different one. This is the workaround. I should have put both of them in there, but I figured I could just make that statement. And somebody wants to verify it, they can. Because if you look, I guess that's Stack Exchange, but that was just a general one. And in fact, it talks about SSH copy ID, and then it says, do these commands and it'll do the equivalent. So essentially what you're doing, let me bring it up so I can be more specific. Okay, if you go down about the middle of the page, where it says you could always do something like this, the equivalent command would be scp, and it's your .ssh/id_rsa.pub. And of course, first step is to do on your machine, the local machine, SSH key gen, which will generate your key and put it in id_rsa.pub. So the first line essentially is you're doing SCP, which is SSH copy, between two machines, and you're going to copy that ID underscore RSA.pub file into the temp directory of your remote remote system. And again, like I said, for target, it's very much like SSH. Username at remote IP colon slash, in this case, you could put it anywhere, but they've put it in temp, slash TMP slash ID underscore RSA dot pub. Okay, then you remote in, you SSH into that remote machine. And I found on most of them, I had, probably because I hadn't done SSH key gen on them, I had to do a makedir home slash dot SSH. In other words, I had to create a dot SSH folder in my home directory first. It wasn't already there. So then you do under your SSH folder, you have a file called authorized underscore keys. And that has a list of all your keys. So you don't want to replace that. What we're doing is, because that would wipe out any other keys that you had, we're going to copy the contents of ID underscore RSA.pub into, you know, using the cat command, we're going to concatenate that to the end of your home slash SSH. And I don't mean literally home, but I mean your user home, tilde slash SSH slash authorized underscore keys. So it's probably a lot more plain if you just look at the link than trying to follow along. But I mean, that's exactly the same thing that SSH dash copy dash ID does. So, you know, I'd like to hear Ike's, opinion of transferring your ID.RSA pub over SCP, because I can't see any difference in the in security there. You know, so if somebody was in your network monitoring your traffic, they could see that go across. And of course, even less secure if you're doing it with, say, a DigitalOcean droplet, which at the same time I did do that to Father Fetch's droplet that I've been borrowing to use for my Quassel IRC server. And, you know, I very rarely SSH into it, but now I can without a password. So, yeah, someone could say if that goes floating across the internet and people know what that package is, or what that packet is, then that at that one point they could hijack your encryption key. But I would say, you know, if it's your home network, I wouldn't worry about security. And like, of course, you could always have somebody in there, but if they're in, you've got way worse problems. I guess the secure way to be would be to copy that file to a thumb drive and sneakernet it over to the other computer. But of course, if it's a DigitalOcean server or something like that, that's not exactly very practical.
Yeah, I'd really be interested in knowing what the justification for, or what the rationalization is for labeling SSH copy ID as insecure. I did a quick search for it, and basically, it was in, like, for the release. Let me check real quick. Yeah, for it looks like the most recent release, it was enabled and then subsequently disabled because it, and the only comment is that it was insecure and weak. So it'd be really interesting to know the background on that one.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people out there maybe wonder why I'm throwing all this Solus stuff in there. It's just that Solus can be a little bit different. So, you know, I'm thinking you might have a listener, if you try Solus, and you know, probably going to run into some of these same issues. And so that I've thrown that stuff out there, so maybe it's not a surprise to you. So, oh yeah, I heard that on a podcast once, that how to get around that, how to do it differently, how to change my thinking or whatever. So, it's probably not going to be helpful to the general majority of the people listening to the podcast, but sometimes I throw stuff out, you know, just for that one listener, because I've been saved by that a lot. You know, I'll be going along, hit something, and, you know, maybe not remember exactly how to fix it, but remember, yeah, I heard that on a podcast once. Let me see if I can figure out what that is.
You know, I agree. I'd really like to see the reasoning behind why they think it's insecure. Because really, you're copying, you're sending text, and it's a public key that you're sending over to the other server. It's not your private key that you're sending to it. So I don't understand why they would say it's insecure. And you're sending it over SSH, so it's the, you know, the same method that you're going to be using to connect to it.
Well, also, I've been thinking, do they mean that key exchange is in, are they saying the particular command because it's sending it across, that sending the key across is insecure, or are they saying the key exchanges are insecure? Because I guess you could say that now that I've done this, anybody could sit down at my computer and SSH into Father Finch's server without having to know the password.
I don't think it's that. I think part of it is the fact that SSH copy ID is just a bash script. I mean, technically, if you have it on your computer right now, you could load it up in a text editor or less or more it from the command line. And yeah, it's just a bash script that basically does exactly those commands. So I mean, maybe because it's a bash script is the reasoning behind that. But I mean, that's the only sort of rationalization that starts to make sense to me.
And who knows? Ike might even respond. I don't know if I got him start. I know he listened to the one show after I told him he was mentioned in it, but I don't know if he's been listening since. But, you know, Ike, if you're out there, then you've heard that, or somebody on the development team for Solus is hearing this. You're always welcome to, you know, send in a response, or, you know, even more welcome to come. Jump in the show, and you know, because a lot of inquiring minds want to know. We're all sort of interested, you know, how this decision was arrived at.
On a completely separate note, the podcast is just called Late Night Linux. It's at latenightlinux.com, and on the info page is described as Late Night Linux is a podcast that takes a look at what's happening with Linux in the wider tech industry. Every 2 weeks, Joe, Jesse, Ike, and I'm going to butcher the hell out of this, Phelim, discuss the latest news and releases and the broader issues and trends in the world of free and open source software. Expect drinking, swearing, strong opinions, and Ike being told to shut up about Solus.
Oh, okay. I'd forgotten that. Ike is actually going to be a regular member. Well, we could all answer this question if... I assume there's probably a feedback. Yeah, there's a contact link. I will post this exact question to that podcast, and then we'll get an answer back.
That's great. Thanks.
And I'll make sure that he knows it's from everybody on Linux Lugcast. Okay. Other topics. I'd mentioned one of the things I thought of using my NanoPyo Neo 4 is, I want to set up sort of a server for my alumni association that I'm involved with. Since I would be probably the only open source user, I'm assuming the response is going to be, well, can't we do all of that on Google Docs? But, you know, I just wanted the experience of setting it up, so I'm going to be putting Nextcloud, Etherpad, and Mattermost on the NanoPy Neo. Maybe see if I can burn it up, because Dor says his runs awful hot with no fan. And also mine's in a printed case that came with it, or a plastic case at least. So, you know, I just got started on that. And the first thing I guess you can install Nextcloud from repositories on most installations, but, well, at least particularly this one on Ubuntu, but it's a truncated version of Nextcloud that doesn't do everything Nextcloud can do. So I was going through those various steps and sort of hung up on the first one. It got to where it was creating headers. It got through the installation. Let me scroll down the particular package. Oh, I guess it was just installing the LAMP server. And it got to the point where it was nearly done and said installing headers, and just hung there. And after about 45 minutes, I decided it wasn't going to get any farther. And, cycled power and couldn't SSH into the box anymore. The flash and lighten weren't flashing like they should have been lighting. So I figure something screwed up. I don't know. It's a 32 gig SD card. I wouldn't think that I'd already overran it, though. I didn't check to see if it had auto expanded. I kind of assumed that it being Armbian Ubuntu that it would have expanded to fill the SD card automatically, but I haven't actually checked on that. So I did, right before the show, overwrite the SD card with the original image. Of course, because I've done the key exchange, I can't actually SSH into it until I wipe out the key for that box on my local system, because it's saying, well, this isn't the same machine that was on that IP address yesterday. You know, you've got a security problem. So I'm doing that, and then I also found instructions for the Mattermost server and the Etherpad Lite server. So I'll be able to talk more about my success or lack thereof on that project, hopefully by the next show. Okay, I wanted to talk about a couple fundraisers that are going on. Reglue is holding their annual Indiegogo fundraiser to keep them going for the next year. So that's a very good cause. And of course, for those not familiar, Reglue is a project down in Texas that takes used computers, installs Linux, and distributes them to high school students that wouldn't otherwise be able to afford a computer. So I actually have the blog post linked where the fundraiser is mentioned, where you would be able to find links to the actual Indiegogo page. The other fundraiser is our friend Jonathan Nadeau. It has published sort of a memoir of his life so far called Vision, or is publishing rather. And it's his journey as someone who lost his sight as a teenager, actually, I guess, regaining his spiritual vision, his purpose in life after losing his eyesight. And of course, as we know, he's behind the I'm blanking on the project name. I will think of it. But the Linux distro for otherwise abled Linux users.
Sonar GNU Linux.
Yes, thank you, Sonar. And of course, has been involved in a number of podcasts of his own hosting. I think he's still got one or two out there. So I can't imagine anybody listening to the show is not familiar with Jonathan Nadeau. He was with us again this on the 24-hour show So the book's written. He just wants, I guess, he's going to self-publish. He'd like a little help with that, and for creating cover graphics and etc. For the book, which obviously, would be something very difficult for him to do. So that's now if you look there, it does say the project is fully funded, but I've heard Jonathan say that he intentionally set that low. He could probably use about 10 times what the project goal is. I mean, anything's a help, but to be fully funded on that, probably 10 times the actual stated goal. So, very, very good cause, very good friend to the Linux community. I'm certain there will be quite a bit about open source in this book. So go there to that link and check it out. It's in the show notes. Okay, finally coming near the end of all my stuff. Next thing, I haven't bought anything yet, but I plan to. The next link down is there's all of a sudden there are a whole bunch of open source projects for digital assistants, and by that I mean Echo-like projects. Usually running on something like a Raspberry Pi. Amazon Echo, if you don't know, it's a little box that you could, or tube or whatever, you set up there on the kitchen counter, and you can ask it questions just like OK Google, or, actually order stuff. That's what they want you to do with it, is actually a voice method to order stuff from Amazon or play music, or ties in your home automation if you have any. And originally Mycroft, that was the, of course, it's a device beyond software. In other words, it's open source software, but they are selling you a Raspberry Pi and other hardware. Well, I shouldn't say selling. Crowdfunding. So that's, Mycroft has been delayed a little bit. I'm still expecting mine. There was an email a week ago that I was afraid the shoe was going to drop because, very much talking about, because you crowdfund the project, even though there is a premium, There's no guarantee that you're going to get the premium. It's, you're crowdfunding because you want this project to go on, not, perhaps without the expectation of a physical project. But then the last line was, we expect to start delivering the Mycroft, in the next month or something. So they have had some unexpected and different problems, but, the original target date was last July, I think, to start delivery. So I'm still anticipating getting mine. But since I, a year and a half ago, I helped fund that project, there have been a bunch of alternatives come out. Of course, there's Alexa, which is essentially the same code that runs Echo. Obviously, I think it's been open sourced, that you can put that on a Raspberry Pi and have a de facto Alexa for $30. But there have been a couple others come out just recently. I've got a link there to the Adrian project, and there's also a Fossbytes with links to a couple other projects that have come out and to Mycroft. So, I think one of them's Melissa, the other one, not so much general use as everything that's come out. So I'm kind of jumping around on my show notes. Before I leave this part, you might also want to look at Lucidia.ai. This is a project out of Clarity Labs in the University of Michigan, or yeah, University of Michigan. I saw the precursor of this was Cirrus demonstrated at PangoCon last year, and this isn't so much aimed towards building this physical device that's going to sit in your kitchen or whatever or your living room. This is more an app on your phone that would do the same thing as OK Google does, but not go through Google servers. Now, I guess they have servers up to go through, but you know, the key of this is if you're willing to invest in the time and the energy consumption of setting up like a dedicated i5 server, because this isn't going to run on any Pi, then you could actually do these informational requests, and essentially they've loaded all of Wikipedia into the thing without it going out to the internet anywhere. So, you know, everything would be private. All these other projects, even the open source ones and Mycroft, the big point has been, yeah, there's no way a Raspberry Pi can translate voice into text. It needs a bigger computer. And usually that means there's a couple projects out there, but the biggest one is Google. And of course, not only is Google hearing, you know, what you're saying, what requests you're making, Google does have a tendency to suddenly and unceremoniously dump free resources they've put out there. So what happens to all these projects if Google decides, you know what, we're going to keep all that resources just for Google Home and we're not going to let everybody freeload off us anymore? So that's one, you know. So I says Lucidia, it used to be Sirius, and that was the first thing I thought when I heard that last year, is isn't that name already taken? So that's probably the main reason for the name change. So if you want something that's going to be private, and you know, if you think your privacy is worth you know, power consumption and the cost of a dedicated i5 server running in your house, then you know, you could definitely look at that project. I'm going to be very interested in looking at it, definitely. But in the meantime, I thought for a while building Alexia, but now we've got these completely open source alternatives. And the good thing about that is, you know, Alexa and stuff, that's still tied into Amazon. And I don't know, you know, I can see that they say that it's only listening after you've said the keyword. So if you've listened to the last couple episodes the mini PC show over on PodNuts, you know that there is a way to get in and see what's been recorded, the voice, and playback the voice recordings that have been sent up to Amazon. And a lot of stuff on there has, you know, nothing to do with talking to Alexa, private family conversations or whatever. So even accidentally, it's sending stuff up to the web that you might not want anybody else hearing. But on top of that, if it's a company like Amazon, well, what happens when the NSA shows up in the middle of the night with a subpoena and your IP address and says, we want that mic open 24/7 so we can listen to it, and by the way, this is double secret authorization, so you can't tell anybody. So on something like that, if I build an Adrian box or a Melissa box or whatever, it's a lot less likely for the NSA, for those who fly so far under the NSA or, you know, any law enforcement's radar, that if I'm worried about my privacy, I would much rather build one of those than an Alexa. So, you know, I've just put links to Amazon stuff, and this is just more for people who are wanting to build their own own Alexa box or whatever, or Adrian or whatever. Most of these links suggested by Adrian on the Adrian website. what you might need. And I've got first, you know, a kit for an RPI 3 for about $10 more. It also comes with a plastic case and a power supply, so it's a pretty good deal. An Olympus mini microphone, USB sound card, and on that, on the Alexa, he's got a link to what looks like a no-name. There's no labeling on it. USB sound card that's available on eBay. And then also a link to USB sound cards that have been verified for the Raspberry Pi. And I was looking for brand names that I recognized, and most of those were fairly expensive, like $30. But when I was looking through the links on Amazon, popped up one that looked just exactly like the one, you know, shown over on eBay, which doesn't mean it's the same card. It just means they're buying the case from the same vendor. But so I took it for $6 versus $30. I took a chance on that. I can always go back and buy the more expensive card later. The Adrian site suggests those old cheap USB powered speakers that came with Dell desktops. But I tried to find those, and the ones he's linked to, he must be in Europe, so they're on British eBay, and yeah, there's a couple out there fairly cheap, or at least no more than they were new, but the shipping would be prohibitive. And then I looked at American eBay, and still the only ones out there were in Europe, and they were wanting $100 for the thing. So no, not for $10 set of speakers. So go on Newegg or whatever and get the cheap. You know, again, I tried to find name brand speakers, and you're paying more than I would want to put into this. So, you know, I'm gonna start looking around the thrift shops for another set of used PC speakers. But full size PC speakers is what the Adrian guy at least recommends. Not micro speakers that would go in a little box. Found this next link is for the hotel room router project. You know, if you base it on a Pi, then you would have to, you know, you got to the room and you did the initial configuration. You would have to plug in to the TV in the room as a display. So to skip that point, I thought it was worth it. Maybe if it was 3.5-inch TFT display that was integrated into an RPI case. So that's what that's for. Extra micro USB power adapters. I don't think I have enough to go around for all the devices I have if they were all plugged in at once. And the next couple things, just because they look really cool. I found the other day a battery pack expansion for the RPI, and it's just USB in one side and USB back out the other side. So you could use it for, you know, battery power, or I think an uninterruptible power supply for the Raspberry Pi, but fairly inexpensive, about $15. I figure it's worth that to try it and see how well it worked. And the second one is one that TJ found several weeks ago, a twin micro SD adapter. So if you wanted to dual boot a Raspberry Pi or a similar device that boots off an SD, what this is the sort of L-shaped, and one end of it looks like a, you know, the connector for a micro SD card. And then on the other end, you have two slots for micro SD cards, and then there's a switch in between. So you could power down, you know, if you wanted to dual boot, you could power down, flip the switch, boot from the other SD card. And I for this project, I'm looking at, if I'm trying to figure out whether I like Adrian or Melissa better, that would be perfect for that without, there's been a couple articles out. Joe put his method, what he's working from, for Boot Crazy, and there was another one the other day talking about dual booting from an SD card. And of course, I'm not talking Noobs or Berry Boot. Obviously, we also already have a way for dual booting, but only if the images that are included with one of those projects is what you want to boot. If you want to roll your own thing, it's a little, it can be done, but it's more involved. So this would be a quick, what, you know, I'd hate to spend 10 days figuring out how to get two images on the one card and find out one of them wasn't worth my time to do. So this would be, you know, this is more for maybe prototyping. It's a little awkward and ungainly, and, you know, one more thing sticking out the side you could break off. But, you know, I think it'd be interesting. And I even suggested to Joe, well, what about if you daisy chain them? So if you plug two more into the bottom of the first one, then you would have four images that you could boot from. Okay, man, I've been droning on and on and on. Oh, yeah, the one last thing. I suspect both Adrian and Melissa are based on Raspbian. I haven't looked. It's too bad that they aren't set up as both just, you know, applications on top of a standard image. I was thinking of putting them, thinking this evening of the possibility to get them both together on the same SD card. You know, use the same underlying operating system and then just switch between the applications. So if I ever figure that out, I think I'll call it Melisandre. Yes, one parting joke after all this droning, which I'm getting tired of doing, so I'm going to let other people talk.
It was a hell of a setup for that punchline.
Yeah, I had to go a very, very long way to find that punchline.
Actually, the twin micro SD adapter is pretty interesting to me. Just I've been looking for a way to cleanly get between RetroPie and OSMC. So that's, I mean, yeah, it looks kind of ugly though. So that's the only sort of downside to it. I would much rather. Have plugins for either of them to jump back and forth, but those solutions, they exist, but they're a bit involved.
So for the idea of that dual card SD card adapter thing, is that what are you worried about the just wear and tear on the SD card slot for pulling it in and out? I mean, wouldn't having to power it off and hitting a switch, or just powered off and swap SD cards, wouldn't that be about the same thing?
For me, it's the attraction is partially laziness, because, well, I'm lazy. And the other part of it from a practical standpoint is, I mean, micro SD cards are small, man. I'm going to lose one if I'm swapping them back and forth. They're not, you know, they're not Nintendo cartridges that you can find pretty easily and hit somebody with.
Yeah, that both your points, Fweeb, are exactly what I was thinking. Plus, you know, $15, it'll be cool. The other application would possibly be my computer that's on the side of my refrigerator now. Right now I have it booting into Android, because that's the best fit for what I want to do with that. But it would be cool if I could seamlessly power it down and boot it up in the Raspbian into a real operating system. Or perhaps Armbian, because I'm starting to like it better. Okay, well, Fweeb, you had a couple top... Go ahead with yours.
Yeah, it's a couple of very, very small things. And one, for anybody who listens to my show... I have a little poll running. It's come time that my show shouldn't live on my personal website and should probably get its own slice of the web, but I've been overthinking which domain name to choose. So because I've been overthinking it, what do overthinking people do? They make a poll so that someone else can decide for me. So I have a link to this poll as to what domain name I should use for the Open Source Creative Podcast and a couple other projects I have related to the open source creative making of things. So if anybody wanted to be kind enough to go on there and click a button and give me your thoughts on it, I'd appreciate that. And then the other small thing is, I'm sure At least I mean, I'm not entirely sure, but I would think that this came up in an episode of our show sometime in the past. But I'm late to the party, and I just discovered this thing, the sink stop, or formerly the USB condom. So I travel not a whole lot, but every now and again. And you know, when you're traveling, or even when you're going to like coffee shops these days, you're seeing people free power updates for phone, or not power updates, but charging stations for phones and tablets and whatnot. And what they are is they're USB ports to that you can plug in there, because a lot of times, especially for airports and whatnot, USB tends to be more universal than whatever plug adapter is available. And I've never used those because, well, they're USB ports, so you can also transfer data on them, and I can't trust them because I'm paranoid. But the sink stop, or the USB condom, is a means that basically it disables or blocks the data pins on any USB cable, so that the only thing that's going to be flowing through it will be power. And so if you do happen to travel or come across or need to charge your various electronic devices by way of USB, if you have any inclination related to security whatsoever, I definitely recommend getting one of these things. I'm likely to.
Oh, and it's not like I haven't bogarted the podcast way too much already, but that does bring up something. Oh, about a year ago, on certain flights, they had not a Wi-Fi that would get you out to an internet, but if you had your phone or a tablet, you know, you could connect to Wi-Fi, and they had all these TV shows and movies and whatever that you could pick. So instead of showing one, you know, movie to everybody in the cabin, which is same movie to everybody, which has only happened one flight for me, started to do this. And now they're starting to put these seat back units in, so you don't even have to have your tablet out. There's a, you know, a 5-inch screen on the back of the seat in front of you, and you can pick you know, movies, whatever. You can also go into a map, shows where your plane is all the time. So that makes me a little scared. Okay, is that tied into the flight system's computer to do that? Or hopefully it's going back out to the web, to the, I don't know why I'm pointing at stuff here, you can't see me. You know, hopefully that's going all the way back out to the web, to the airline's website, and pulling that down. Because that's a little scary if that's, you know, if there's not a hard fire, or, you know, a complete air gap between the plane systems and whatever this thing is on the back of the seat. And even scarier, you know, which, you know, something Fweeb said, on this thing is a USB port, so that you could play, you know, I guess play your own movie. That gets a little too close to letting somebody get in and fiddle with my plane that I'm flying on.
Well, I wouldn't worry about the flight map thing. I mean, they've been doing that for a number of years now, and but I mean, actually that. Most of those systems are running Linux. I've actually seen one boot up and see little tuxes boot up with it, which is kind of cool. And I mean, it's a local map they have stored on a hard drive, and they get GPS coordinates and it feeds to that way. It's basically old school GPS. So that's on that front, that's nothing to worry about. And then the USB port, I never use it because again, I'm paranoid. But a lot of those are there for charging more than any kind of data transfer, and that's where something like the sink stop is valuable.
Okay, yeah, I can see how that would be. It all they would need is a separate GPS. You know, because that is a feature I've always thought was cool. You know, especially when you're flying at night and you see all these lights down below you, it'd be, you know, and you see something that looks like a major city, it'd be nice to know where you were flying. And so I do like that feature, but I just that's reassuring that all you would have to need for that is a separate GPS rather than having it talk to the cockpit.
Yep, that's it for me on that front. I know Netminer show notes have a link to latenightlinux.com. Is there anything else you wanted to say about that, Netminer?
Actually, I just threw that in there. I don't know what happened. I was trying to put in the put my, that link in the show notes, and somehow I was able to delete my my name off the list there. So I'm having that type of a night. That's all I can say.
Technologically wizardry at its best. That's fantastic. All right. Well, I guess that being the case, is there anything else anyone else wanted to bring up or talk about?
I just have to refresh mine so that I can get the new links. I still have blanks. I'll do that another time. Just no topics here. Just glad to hear so much. I may have some Raspberry Pi stuff just to mention another time, but I think I'll do it when we're not pushing midnight.
Sounds good to me. Well, that being the case, let me work our way through the outro. Our next recording date is January 20th, 2017. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. Thank you, Tony, from the Sunday Morning Linux Review. Holy man, I can't speak today. For our web hosting, WordPress support, email listserv, and a very nice script to keep our IRC bot connected. And we also want to thank Delwyn for providing the Mumble server we use to create and for creating the bot module to find the next show and recording date. If you're on our IRC channel, just type .ns. And it will tell you when the next show is going to be. That's about it. Signing off, we have 5150.
Yeah, and I apologize for there being way too much 5150 for one episode.
Honky Bagoo.
50 never apologize for creating content.
Netminer.
Never enough 5150.
And Tony Beans.
Good night. Hey, it's been a good night. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Have a good night, folks. Happy New Year again.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio-only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget, the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunk. If you don't like the gas, you can get up your ass.
Ain't no funny duddies, that'll make it bad. G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.